I'm Jonna Kaplan.
And I'm Carrie Provost, and you're listening to Going Steady,
a podcast about exploring places in the land of steady habits and beyond.
So we're back in a car, even though I think we said we weren't going to do that, but we are.
We are. Same car, different city.
Yes. So we're in New Haven today. I took the train down.
It's a beautiful day, and we are going to talk about a weird mash of stuff.
Which will include some of our favorite New England books and things that make us never want to leave the house. But first, we have a lot of Connecticut-ish things that are just driving us crazy that I think we need to talk about.
Yeah, so we're going to do kind of like a rapid fire of Connecticut issues that we've been thinking about.
George Washington. I have to start with this because, you know, he did not sleep everywhere. And I thought this was well known. I thought this was settled. So there are books and maps by credible sources that have used lots of research, including George Washington's own notes, receipts. They really tracked well where he traveled. Using that information, you can determine where he rode and where he slept. So he has gone through many towns in Connecticut, but he would vary his routes a bit as he wanted to see more of the place, I guess. He didn't always take what we might think of as the most efficient routes, and he did not sleep everywhere. So we know that he slept in Ashford because he was kvetching about it. He did not like where he slept, and he made a big deal. So we know he definitely slept there, and I'm not going to name all the towns, but we know that he definitely slept in Coventry, Windsor, Hartford, Norwich, Middletown, Wallingford, Mansfield, Farmington. There are some others, but he did not sleep everywhere. So that's just something that's been, like, really driving me crazy.
But the point, I think people get hung up on slept because the point that it's making fun of remains true, that he traveled a great deal and he you know, had a lot of dinners and meetings in a lot of towns all up and down the eastern seaboard, pretty much. And he doesn't need to have actually technically slept in a house for there to be Revolutionary War history in that town.
Valentine's Day.
Yes, which has just passed.
Yes. So is that a thing that you have comments about? I feel like you do.
In general, it annoys me. I don't like the holiday. It's something that I've actually had men disbelieve that a woman could not be into Valentine's Day, I guess, and say, no, you know, you're just... And it's like, no, really, I find this day extremely annoying. And if I was dating a man who tried to buy me roses and chocolates on February 14th, I would be so disappointed that he was so unoriginal, and it would be a deal breaker, honestly. Like, celebrate your love on another day, people. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so I don't like the idea of it being, like, the only time people make a show or whatever, but I don't totally hate it. Some restaurants will have a special Valentine's Day menu, and they will make that available a day in advance of Valentine's Day. So maybe you want to go out but not be around a bunch of other people, but you want, like, a nice different menu at a place. That's an option, people. So, you know, if you have a place you like, call them and find out. The other thing is, if you're a regular, so I don't mean you're going in there a place every single week, you will probably be able to get a table on Valentine's Day if that's a thing that's important to you, because, you know, a restaurant's going to value the business of someone they know is coming back. So just saying, personal experience, you can not have an RSVP.
Also, I would imagine that chocolate goes on sale the day after, so
Absolutely.
Stock up. Like any holiday, like... that's, you know, that has the candy and the special color wrappers, that's probably a good time to stock up on...
Yeah, it's not a bad idea to say, I love you with twice as much chocolate the day after.
Just that's a good idea, actually. Take note.
And something else is just maybe you can also just treat it as a regular Friday night out. So Spotlight Theater in Hartford, they have a little dinner. And then they have stuff that's, like, a little step up from that. So veggie wraps and pizza and stuff. Like, it's not five star, okay? But you can get food and you can get cocktails and put it on a tray and go into a movie theater and see something like Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey, such as I did. And there'll be people in the theater, but it won't be packed. Okay, so it's not, like, a romantic thing, but you can still go out and not have it be horrible, cliche. Yeah.
Yeah. I one thing that I do like about Valentine's Day is the color scheme. It's not something I'd want to see all the time, but I think the red and pink is super cute, and I like hearts, you know. I like all that stuff. I just don't like the weird commercial pressure.
Right.
I posted this on Instagram, but one February, I was a temp at an edible arrangements, and seeing all the panicked men coming in looking for chocolate-covered strawberries, it just really, it makes the whole thing so tawdry and sad.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I'm having a fruit emergency.
Yeah.
While I make fun of that, and I always think, like, why would anybody get a basket of fruit? But I've had two people give me that, like, not for Valentine's Day, just for, like, other things, and I've always appreciated it.
Oh, they're really good.
They are good.
The chocolate-dipped fruits, they're really quite good, but the feeling that if you don't procure one on February 14th, you'll be, like, dumped, it's really sad to me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway, that's my Valentine's Day rant.
That was a useful rant. Those are some local tips. Yeah.
And I guess my last thing, and I think Steve CTMQ brought this up recently, and it refreshed the whole idea for me. But then, I don't know. We'll just credit him, though. Only in your state.
Yeah, I always think of Steve when I think of Only in Your State, because he's been ranting about it for, I want to say, years.
For years, and no one listens, and I wish they would listen. Like, I get it. You're happy because a website mentioned your business or place you like. Please stop linking to Only in Your State, because one, it's got no depth. Two, the people who wrote probably never went there. Three, they rip off photos. Okay, and there are other reasons, but like, I hate it so much. Find content that is complementary to the things that you produce or enjoy that isn't so crappy.
Yeah, and if you're listening and you have no idea what this is, it's this website, and they have, you know, associated social media Only in Your State. I will say on Instagram, they don't rip off photos, so I do tag them, because if you can't use the horrible corporate websites for your own advantage, what are they good for? But so they have one for every state, and there are these kind of mass produced, like, junky, like, what to do, where to go, what to see articles with almost entirely factually incorrect information.
Yeah,
sometimes it's a little bit true, but they'll be like, oh, this one park in Connecticut is the best thing you'll ever see, and it'll be like some little tiny municipal park with the swing set in it. It do not use it for advice. And like anything in this vein, I completely agree that the problem is the people, sometimes legitimate sites that will link to it because they're so proud that their town was mentioned in it. And you know, I think people have a right to create whatever crappy website they want to, but you don't need to give it attention. Let it die a natural death. Yep. Go promote a website that shares, we were talking about Atlas Obscura earlier. That's a good site. I've written for them. They have real editors. It's verified. The people who write about interesting places on there are doing real journalism. Mm-hmm. You know, if your town is mentioned in a place like that, that's great. I understand why a local news station or something would retweet that, but don't pay any attention to the, and it's the same with like Wallet Hub and all these little, it drives me crazy.
You know, when it says something like the 10 places to have great adventures or whatever in Connecticut, and the top one is Bushnell Park in Hartford, and I'm like, look, I like Bushnell Park, I walk through it daily, I don't know that I've ever really had an adventure there. It's a cool place to have a picnic or listen to jazz, go on a carousel ride. If that's your adventure threshold, I don't know.
The only adventure you're gonna have in Bushnell Park is like forgetting on which side of the Capitol you parked and having to walk all the way around. Moving on, we had a bunch of stuff that we wrote down that we were going to complain about the president.
Yep. So I don't think it's any secret. Like, I don't think anyone listening would have been like, oh, I thought they were Trump supporters.
Yeah, no, sorry.
So, yeah. No. Yeah, this set me off because I saw that he just earmarked $300,000 for the Ronald Reagan Boyhood Home National Historic Site in Dixon, Illinois. while trying to, again, so he's done this every year, he wants to cut the Institute of Museum and Library Services, National Endowment for the Humanities, National Endowment for the Arts. Every year, Congress has rejected it, and I think sometimes it even has increased the funding to these. But what I've learned is not to get too complacent, because I also thought, what are the odds that anyone would vote for him for president? So, I don't want to be overly worried, but how do we even respond to this? Like, what does this mean if any of these cuts go through? What does that mean for our ability to explore in Connecticut or beyond there?
As far as how to respond to him, I don't know. I think the whole country has been trying to figure that out and failing. He's just a kind of horrible that we've never really had to deal with. But as far as the cuts, though, I think it's easy to see from past events how dramatically those kinds of cuts can affect tourists and travelers' experiences. I mean, think about the government shutdowns mm-hmm. and the national parks. Yeah. That kind of instantly creates this huge, like, bad situation with garbage piling up and people's vacations getting ruined. And, or even on a much smaller scale, I'm thinking about the Old Newgate Prison mm-hmm. in Connecticut and how that site was closed for so long. And then I went when it reopened, and it was just like, wow, this is a really great resource that since we have it preserved, we really should be promoting it and getting as many people to see it as we can. And when something like that closes, or when a museum has to reduce hours or staff, it really just, it seems like, well, there's other things to do, and there are, but sometimes it's just having that critical mass of like 5 or 6 things to do in one area that really bring people in, and that helps the economy a ton.
And just to clarify, like, I don't think that if this went through, the way that the funding structures work, I don't think it means that we're going to have a bunch of places get shuttered.
Right.
But it's chipping away at programs, it's delaying projects, not having the staffing that is wanted. You get a degraded experience. We deserve more than that, right? So I would just say, like, dude, why do you hate the arts so much? Like, what's your problem? And the other thing is that then they have to fill the gaps, right? So these institutions have to figure out other funding sources. That can be raising admission rates. It could be getting more corporate sponsorship, which, depending on how the place does that, it can be okay, or it can be kind of crappy, where suddenly you get, exhibits that are sponsored, but you get exhibits that they wouldn't have had otherwise, and maybe shouldn't have had otherwise, because that's where the money went. So, like, locally, the NEA in recent years, some of the places that they've awarded grants to, that's included Real Artways in Hartford. I recently saw this film, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, there. I saw, like, the preview of it, and they're going to actually start showing that regularly pretty soon. It was fantastic. They have Cat Video Fest coming on the 28th. New Haven's International Festival of Arts and Ideas has been a recipient. ArtSpace New Haven, Litchfield Performing Arts, American Mural Project in Winsted, the Eugene O'Neill Theater in Waterford. So that's just a few there. National Endowment of the Humanities, that's harder to, like, conceptualize, I think, for the average person, how that money gets rewarded, but it's helped fund projects associated with Yale, UConn, Connecticut College, the Mark Twain House Museum, Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, among others. You know, if you're listening, you've probably been to one or more of those places in some way. The IMLS, that's the museums and libraries that get funding. Discovery Museums, Mystic Aquaria, Mohegan Tribe for their Native American Library Services. One of the more interesting projects, I think, was rewarded to the Connecticut Landmarks and this is a quote here, to develop an interpretive plan for the Palmer Warner House in East Haddam, which presents an intact, rich collection of gay rural life from 1945 to 1971. Who knew?
Being from southeastern Connecticut, I'm also thinking it's not just our, like, liberal, elite, intellectual, bleeding heart stuff that we love that is has proposed cuts, but it's also the Coast Guard and the Navy building submarines. Those are in his proposed budget to be slashed. The stuff is important for the nation, for our homeland security, for our, if you fall off a boat, right? Like, you kind of need...
I'm on board with that part. So, yeah. Like, personally, I could go with the slashing of the military industry, but I think you still have to do it the right way. Like, transition to a green economy. Make sure that you're not, like, just leaving people high and dry. They've got families to support. They've got themselves to support.
Right. Like, regardless. If a whole region. Like, right now, there's, I think, 300 people at Electric Boat who are furloughed. So they're not unemployed. But, you know, you're not going to go out and buy a house or something if you're furloughed.
Right. So you're not making any kind of big financial decisions.
It really stalls an area's economy that is already kind of in a precarious mm-hmm. position. And I wonder, I don't know the answer to this, but whether Connecticut, due to its size and its, you know, existing kind of blah economy, whether cuts like these hit us harder than a state that's maybe got a lot more going on or a lot more options. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And given that Trump is not exactly going around the world creating peace in his wake,
right.
I think we kind of do need a military that's strong.
That's a fair point. I don't understand. Well, there's no logic involved. Like, there's
none. No, right. And yeah, exactly. There's never logic. It's just sad. It's sad to see, like, a place that, even when it's not Trump-related, when it's something local, like tolls, mm-hmm. it's just frustrating to see these people go round yeah. and round.
And I saw a comment, because I was stupid and read comments on this, on, because Blumenthal spoke out about the IMLS stuff on President's Day, which would have been more of a slap, except that, what you have to call Trump out, like, every day, so whatever. President's Day, it's just, like, one more day of the week, right? But somebody made this comment of, like, well, good, like, why are we funding libraries, like, books, like, it was like, this books are obsolete, and I was just like, dude, have you been in a library? Like, do you know what happens in libraries? Like, first of all, I will fight you, books are not obsolete, but also, like, there's so many other services.
Right. People like that just make me ragey. Like, I want those people to fall off a boat and not have the Coast Guard to rescue them.
Ding. It's the same people who complain that, you know, oh, we have all these immigrants and they need to learn English. But guess where they learn that? At the library.
Right. And, you know, if books were obsolete, which they're clearly not, like, Bookstagram and BookTube, check that out if you think books are obsolete. But, you know, even if they were, well, maybe that's why America's getting dumber by the minute.
Yeah. So, speaking of books.
Yes.
Because they are not obsolete. We were talking about something nicer, I guess, which is New England books. We have not consulted in advance about, like, what some of our favorite...
We have no idea.
And we were just saying New England books, so I don't know if that means made in New England.
No, I was thinking any kind of genre that fits in with... because we did top five travel books yeah. in a previous episode, so I thought, what if we did our top five New England-related books, just related to the region in any way?
Okay.
Okay, so my first is Old Seaport Towns of New England by Hildegard Hawthorne. A lot of mine are, like, travel and history related. Mm-hmm. Shocker. I probably could have gone in many directions, but I literally went to my bookshelf mm-hmm. and I went through. And the first five that I picked out and said, oh, I love this book, that's what I picked. So this book is about a 1916 train trip that Hawthorne and her sister took from Portland to New Haven. And they stopped in, I think it's 12 different seaport towns, and just gave it's a travel guide, essentially, but it's also a travel narrative, and it just talks about what there is to do in these towns, what they did. It's a lot of history and just observation, and she was a really prolific writer who wrote in pretty much every genre, and yes, she was related to Nathaniel Hawthorne, so mm-hmm. long New England family connections and Connecticut connections, too. And I just love this book. Like, if you love traveling by the seaside, you will love this book.
That sounds delightful.
It really is.
I'll start with, like, a cop-out, which is, like, Stephen King's books, also lowbrow. I can't narrow it to one, and I recently saw this meme, and I couldn't find it when I was looking for it again. But essentially, the meme was something like, before moving to New England, I assumed Stephen King was a fiction writer, and now I see.
That's funny. I've never actually heard that. So
I just saw this the other day, and I couldn't remember who posted it, so I couldn't find it again. But, yeah, I think that, of course, it's, like, a little bit off, but... And it was mentioning, like, the antique dealer who had a pact with the devil or something. I think that, you know, his descriptions of the geography are okay, but it's really, like, capturing the people in New England in a number of his books. I can see it. Like, they're people that I know, right? Not necessarily doing like the worst things ever or whatever, but I can envision them well. It, the stand, you could just go on and on. So yeah, it's a little bit of a cop-out, just author, but I just feel like I couldn't get away from adding Stephen King to my list.
My second book is Connecticut, A Guide to Its Roads, Lore, and People, which is the Federal Writers Project guidebook for Connecticut. During the New Deal, one project was to create guidebooks for every state, and so this is an absolutely massive tome that covers pretty much every city, town. My favorite part are the driving routes that I used to try to follow for my old blog. It's in my archives now if you're interested in some of them. It's just really interesting to see what's same and what's unrecognizable since the 30s. Plus, it's surprisingly entertaining. They give a lot of historical anecdotes and facts. If you try to follow any of the travel routes, you start to try to imagine how the writers actually put this together. And my conclusion was that at some points they must have been drunk, but it's just a really fun but also like educational book.
And I've read that, and yes, they have the section on like geology, and they just
go through, really comprehensive.
It's very detailed. Yeah. The Outermost House by Henry Beston, which I think it's very lovely and an indulgent kind of read when you want to escape to a dune shack on Cape Cod. I brought a little thing to read, and I realized it wasn't the best excerpt, so I won't, but it gets, I don't want to call it like a transcendentalist, but it sort of, you know, it's poetic, so recommended if you like Cape Cod.
Sounds interesting. I've never heard of it. Colonial American Travel Narratives, which this is a Penguin Classic book that I have. I don't know if it's always packaged like this, but it has four diaries and three of them are about New England. So I could have chosen other examples of diaries like this, like the diary of Joshua Hempstead. But this one in particular has a white woman who is kidnapped by Native Americans. There's another woman who travels from Boston to New York on horseback, and there's a man who travels from Maryland to New Hampshire and back to improve his health. I don't see how that would improve your health, but I love journals like this that show daily life of normal people from the past in this area and just shows how people thought and behaved, especially when it's travel related, because it was so difficult back then to travel. This is like 1600s, 1700s, and it was so difficult back then to travel between even short distances, and especially mm-hmm. these long distances. It was just, the roads were just not there. So places were so much more localized, and people were so different, and cultures were so distinct from one state to the next, or even sometimes like one town to the next, that it's just really interesting to hear people's observations of behavior, and even language is quite different from place to place.
When people complain about our potholes, I don't think they have any idea of how bad the roads used to be, to the point that where if someone was trying to go from Boston to New York and they didn't have any reason to pass through Connecticut, they would go from like a stagecoach from Boston to Rhode Island, or maybe to like the New London area, and then they would go and get on a boat and go the rest of the way to New York by boat because our roads were that crappy. Zsumpa Lahiri, who, and I don't have a, like with Stephen King, I think that although her writing is not at all like Stephen King's, but she has several of her books set in New England. And I think that in her case, she does a great job of depicting the place. So I think that what we really need is a collaboration between her and Stephen King so that we can, like, I can see the creepy characters, but like set in Boston or something. Like, I think that would be an amazing collaboration.
Okay, here's my more lowbrow contribution. Paul Revere's Ride by David Haggett Fisher. I know it's like very popular history, so I know a lot of people look down on it, but I think he just tells a very entertaining story. And I like this book because it uses a lot of quotes and anecdotes, and it really kind of humanizes this time period that we mythologize a lot of the time, like with George mm-hmm. Washington slept here. It kind of goes back to like, you know, the real story is good enough, and it's usually more entertaining than the myth story of it. Just entertaining. Like, there's this little story about how, I think it's John Adams and John Hancock are, like, trying to cook and eat a salmon for dinner, and they really want this fish, but they keep getting chased out of houses by the British troops approaching, and so they're, like, they have to grab the salmon and go, like, hide in the woods, and then they have to go to, like, some other house, and Hancock is like, okay, now we can eat the salmon, but then the British are coming, and, you know, it's just, like, really...
So, you know, I have to do, like, quick shout-outs to, like, Louise May Alcott and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. Like, you know, yes, I secretly enjoy all those things. But I actually, Elizabeth George Spears' Witch of Blackbird Pond, I was rereading parts of it recently and realizing that how good the description of Weathersfield is.
Yeah, it's good. I know it has a few historical inaccuracies, but yeah. It makes me think that YA used to be better. Okay, so my last one is The Life of John Ledyard, The American Traveler by Jared Sparks. So it's not about New England per se, but it's about a famous Connecticutian. There are other biographies of Ledyard. I have two modern ones in addition to this one on my shelf, but I picked this one because Sparks was close to being a contemporary of Ledyard, and he is from Willington, while Ledyard is from Groton, so it's kind of like double Connecticut. And even though the stories are about like these exotic, far-flung travels of Ledyard's, I've always been fascinated by his personality, and I think his life is so emblematic of a certain type of Connecticut native from the 18th and 19th century. There's just this urge to travel, but then also to return home that I really relate to, and I think it's just interesting, like, there's so much of Connecticut and Southern New England as a whole that is, like, there's so much exploration and travel and, you know, even the commercial aspects of it, like whaling, it's so much of it is associated with going off to sea and exploring and seeing what's out there. And maybe it comes from being from such a small place that you want to just get out there, and or maybe it's the connection to the sea. I don't know. But yeah, I relate to Ledyard and his inability to stay home very well.
I think there's a Jared Sparks Road in Willington.
There should be.
Like full, it's like full name.
I have to go find it now.
But I guess there's like a Colonel, whatever, Ledyard.
Yeah, well, highway, there's a town of Ledyard, which is not John Ledyard, but is,
The Poetry of Donald Hall. I was introduced to his stuff in a creative writing class in, like, 1997, and it stuck with me. And I don't think I picked necessarily the best poem. I'm not going to read the whole thing because this is not a poetry reading, but I'll read a little part of it to give a sense of, like, why I think, and I could have probably picked, like, anything by him, but why I think it really does something. It's very New England-y. So this is from one called Maple Syrup, and there's lots of graves mentioned and stuff, but I'll just read, like, two stanzas. So he wrote, "I remember coming to the farm in March in sugaring time as a small boy. He carried the pails of sap, 16-quart buckets dangling from each end of a wooden yoke that lay across his shoulders, and emptied them into a vat in the sap house where fire burned day and night for a week. Now the sap house tilts nearly to the ground like someone exhausted to the point of death, and next winter when the snow piles 3 feet thick on the roofs of the cold farm, the sap house will shudder and slide with the snow to the ground." And I just want to say, like, if people, you know, don't read poetry and have very little exposure to it, I would say that you're often assigned to read Robert Frost, but you should be reading Donald Hall.
And finally, we're going to talk about scary things, as we often do. This edition of Scary Things, sponsored by coronavirus, which now has a name that I don't remember, so we're just going to call it the Scary New Coronavirus. We were thinking about traveling in a time like this, and do you change the way you travel? Would you cancel plans? Are you terrified of catching the plague? What do you think?
So I don't go on cruise ships. But I do wonder, like, if I had booked a cruise anywhere, would I still want to do that? It's a lot of time spent in a contained space with people. I don't know. I'd probably just go ahead and, like, I'd probably cancel that.
I also would not go on a cruise anyway, ever. Only one of the reasons why being that they are, at the best of times, like little petri dishes for disease.
Right.
I think with any travel plan, I would be much more likely to avoid making a new plan than to cancel an existing plan. But I definitely would cancel something if I thought that the relevant authorities didn't have a plan in place in case of emergency, or if I thought that they didn't have a good way to prevent a preventable emergency, and this kind of seems to be like that. the fact that the State Department and the CDC were disagreeing about what to do with these patients, and mm-hmm. and it was kind of a fight, and the fact that, oh, back to Trump again, that he dismantled the team that Obama had compiled to deal with the Ebola outbreak, and it just seems like you have these cruise ships and no country really has, there doesn't seem to be a worldwide policy or even a consistent countrywide policy. I could easily see the what's happening with cruise ships become something that happens to planes. Mm. You know, if some people are up in the air in a plane and one person dies, God forbid, or something, yeah. You know, where's that plane going to land, etc. So, yeah, I could see that becoming something that would make me want to cancel.
I think if somebody dies while in the air, I think they keep them on the plane until
regular. But if it's a contagion situation,
yeah,
I could see, like, some countries saying, no, you can't land that plane here.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you've looked at this one more carefully than I have.
Maybe I just panic about stuff, but...
Well, no, I mean, I have a friend who's an epidemiologist, and now this was about a month ago when she posted this, so I don't know if she feels differently now, but she was like, you know, for everyone who's upset about the coronavirus, we have something right now. It's called the flu.
Right,
like,
and I hear that a lot, and right. I think, right, and that's what I think of when I try to, you know, myself down about it, but as far as I understand it, this is, much less is known about this. There's no vaccine. Right. The flu, although there are certainly different strains, I think the flu's been around all our lives, and we all know, like, are you a person who's prone to catching the flu? Are you a person mm-hmm. like me who's never actually caught the flu? And who knows, you know, since I don't work in an office, since I'm not around children mm-hmm. or immunocompromised people often, I feel pretty safe in, like, mm-hmm. saying that my lifestyle precautions, I probably... knock on wood, I'm not going to get the flu mm-hmm. if I haven't before. And if I was going to be in a situation where it was more likely, there would be things I could do. This is an unknown, so...
So, yeah, like, I wouldn't go book a place, you know, a trip to a place that is experiencing any kind of major anything, like, whether it's, like, they're in the middle of a war or they've got something, like, nasty going on virus-wise, like... Maybe wait and see how that goes.
Or just the train, too. That's what worries yeah. me. Like, I took the train to Boston a couple weeks ago, and just, you know, I was happy that no one on the train was hacking up a lung, because sometimes, pretty much always when you're on a train, uh-huh. there's at least that one person in there that's sick. And I always just want to wrap my scarf around my head and just be like, not today, you know? And maybe yeah. that comes from just years of having no health insurance, but I'm mm-hmm. very, like, when I think somebody might have anything, a cold, anything, I just want to get the hell away.
Yeah, I heard somebody, it wasn't, like, constant, but someone coughing a little bit on the train somewhere. I'm like, is that a smoker's cough? Let that be a smoker's cough.
Disease is a thing that scares me, and, you know, like you said about war, like, that kind of stuff does not, if there's, like, a war or, you know, a terror threat, depending on the specifics of it, maybe, right. but that kind of stuff does not put me off. I'm like, yeah, come for me, you assholes. but something like a contagious disease, I'm terrified of that kind of thing. The flu is not trying to make you stay home out of fear. Not, like, resisting.
Yeah.
When you go out in a place where people might have the flu, you're just being dumb, you know? So, yeah, that definitely bothers me, and I admit it's, like, something I get extremely anxious about, like, health probably more than right. anything else.
But, you know, speaking of the anti-vaccine stuff, I've actually... So there have been a lot of anti-vaxxers in my neighborhood lately because I live near the state capitol. They've been protesting the religious exemption change, even though almost none of them have a religious reason for wanting to not vaccinate. It's all, like, government shouldn't tell me what to do, or I Google things and know more than someone who has years of medical training.
Yeah, there are, like, almost no religions that have a legitimate objection. Like, none of the major religions.
I had to bring this, like, explain this to somebody the other day, because she's like, but there's the Jews in upstate New York. I'm like, they're not vaccinating cultural reasons, and it has nothing to do with religious reasons. There is
nothing to do with Jewish culture.
Right.
It's very specific to misinformation that has been mm-hmm. spread within their own very small, rather isolated, like, community. Right. It's just ignorance, same as, like, the dirty hippies in California. Yeah. It's not, like, believe me, Jews love doctors. We like right? we like to be healthy. We like to go to the doctor. We like to get treatment. Like, we're not opposed to medicine.
Yeah, talk about conspiracy theories. Like, how does that, like, right. level of
Like, anyway. You have all the Nobel Prizes in medicine, and you're also, like, scared of needles. No, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, yeah, and I just didn't want to get into it. This person trying to explain, like, so yes, you've got the people who are all, like, you know, my crystals are going to save me, and they're in my neighborhood, and I'm not dodging it because I think they're going to make me sick. I'm dodging them because I will fight them. Like, it makes me so livid because... It's, you know, there have been studies on who gravitates towards this, and they tend to be people who are more affluent, although that's always the case. And I'm like, so you got shots when you were a kid, you're healthy, and you're going to put your children and other people at risk for things that are preventable diseases. That's selfish, and get over yourselves and go, like, get off the Google machine and really bad sources lacking credibility and go learn some shit.
I would totally avoid those people, and I would avoid them because I would be afraid that they all have measles.
Yeah.
Like, they would be the kind of people who, when their kid gets a disease, they, like, make all the other kids hang out with them and, like, lick each other so they all get it. like, no, I don't want to be anywhere near you.
Well, and the things that you hear about, like, well, measles, they're not deadly. I'm like, okay, maybe not all the time, but they also, like, create other long-term problems, and
it's gobsmacking the ignorance.
Why would you want your kid to suffer unnecessarily? We're not talking about, like, let's get your kid to build some character by raking leaves.
No.
You know, this is, like, it's just really cruel. And
so, to turn this to a slightly more positive direction, what kind of things do you do when you do travel to stay healthy?
Oh gosh, I've been getting flu shots, which has, like, been my big thing of, like, just trying to stay out of doctor's offices, and washing my hands a lot. And I have, if I go into a place and I notice that there's, like, a visibly sick waiter or barista or something, I walk right out, and I don't worry if I'm hurting somebody's feelings. Because I'm like, no, not today. You're not going to, like, hack all over me. I understand that you're in a situation where you can't call out of work, and that's crap, and that's, like, a big social problem we have to deal with. But I'm not going to be part of this.
That's a good hack, actually. Yeah, I also, hand washing is important. I always drink lots of water. Which I do at home, too, but I try not to ever use traveling as an excuse to, like, eat junk, which I think a lot of people do, but, like, I always drink a lot of water. I take vitamins with me so I can take the same ones I take at home. I try to get lots of sleep like I do at home. I try to eat really healthy. Like, I don't eat junk food. If I'm on a road trip, like, I'll go to the grocery store and buy fruit. I just, it's not always possible to do, but if it is, I will try to stick closer to my own time zone than the time zone I'm in if I'm not going to be there for a long time. Obviously, that's not practical if you're, like, on a 6-hour difference, but if you're on a 2-hour difference, like, and you don't have plans at certain times, like, you can totally get up at 4 a.m. instead of 6 or whatever, and I think it helps to keep you, just keep your immune system strong if you stay on a routine. I also always bring flip-flops because I don't trust hotel carpets to not be disgusting.
That's good advice. As I don't trust them to not be disgusting, but I don't have that kind of foresight.
Yeah, always bring flip-flops and always bring a sweatshirt, even if you're going someplace really hot, because sometimes you can't turn down the AC in the hotel. And that's one thing, like, that temperature fluctuation will always make me feel, like, really shivery and weird if I go into a hotel and it's, like, you know, 40 degrees in the room, and it's, like, you... So, yeah, I always have, like, layers and flip-flops. Another weird little thing, and maybe this doesn't affect other people, but one lesson it took me quite a while to learn was to never travel with wet hair. So if you have to get up early in the morning and get on a flight, or, you know, get in the car and drive for 8 hours, especially if it's cold out, and you go with wet hair, and then you end up in all that artificial heating and artificial recycled air. I did that quite a few times before I realized it would cause me to completely lose my voice the next day. I would just be, like, completely unable to talk and not be able to go to work. So always dry my hair so I'm never out with wet hair in the cold. That sounds like an old wives' tale, and maybe it is, but it absolutely does affect me. So if you find yourself losing your voice when you travel, like, it might be due to the temperature thing going on with having wet, cold hair.
We have to recognize that our bodies change as we get older, and things that we could do when we were 16 are not things we can do anymore. So I used to always go out with wet hair, no problem. And I find that it bothers me more. Like, I'm a lot, even though our winters are not as cold as they used to be, I'll be much less comfortable a lot faster if I leave the house with wet hair. So I almost never do it anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Like, listen to your own body, and age is such a, I mean, I used to be able to drink coffee all day and have five drinks a night and be totally fine. I cannot do either thing anymore.
Five drinks sounds like death right now. Like, a friend who's like, I had one glass of, like, one cocktail, I had a hangover. I'm like, yes, welcome. Yeah. Welcome to my age bracket, kiddo.
Yeah, I went to this lovely cocktail bar in Boston, and I got one glass of red wine, and then I went home and, like, went to sleep at 10, because that's life now.
I don't think I can drink red wine anymore. I think it gives me headaches now.
Oh, no.
I think that's, yeah.
And it's probably, well, there's a lot of other things, too. Like, you know, if you get an injury, like, I used to be able to walk for 20 miles a day, and I hurt my knees, and now I can't. You know, I can walk, like, 6 miles, and then they start to hurt, and you have to recognize these things, because anything that you, like, do to harm yourself, it's worse if you're, like, hundreds or thousands of miles away from home. You don't have to be, like, old. Like, my knees kind of gave out at 30, so just... Yeah. Like, yeah. You're not invincible. You can hurt your knees and you can get the coronavirus, so be careful.
There are a few Patreon supporters who we would like to thank. Allison, Anthony, Benjamin, Brian, Constanza, H.S., Margo Lynn, Mary, Matthew, Nancy, and Steve.
Your support helps Going Steady keep going steady. Thank you.
You can now listen to Going Steady on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and the Apple Podcasts app.
If you'd like to rate or review us over there, that would be a great help. You can also subscribe to Going Steady and receive notifications by email. Sign up at goingsteadyct.com. That's goingsteadyct.com. Comments, suggestions for future episodes, hit us up at goingsteadyct.com.